Yes.
Okay, everyone. Good to see you all. It's September Labor Day in the United States, September 7th.
And in Canada.
And in Canada, too. Okay, good. This is the 16th in our continuing series. As always, let me just follow up with some comments quickly here. Getting back again to the issue we spoke about marriage to a Kohen from a woman converted as a child. And we saw that Rabbi Greenblatt says he spoke to Moshe Feinstein, and Moshe Feinstein agreed in this emergency case you can. And then last class we dealt more with this. Joel Wawelski sends me from the, I forgot about this, Mesoras Moshe, volume one, page 393. They asked Rav Moshe this, at least what he records, and Rav Moshe was absolutely opposed to this possible heter. So we have a bit of a contradiction here. Continuing with the Glock Kosher, this is just one other thing I think you'll find of interest. I only saw this over Shabbos. I had printed it out, but I hadn't yet read it. There's a book, you can see it on HebrewBooks.org, Minhagei Yeshiva Torah Vadas. It actually grammatically should be Yeshivat, or Yeshivas Torah Vadas. But they have the Minhagim of Yeshivas Torah Vadas. Torah Vadas, actually, although the Rosh Yeshiva were Litvish, the Baal Batim founded it. Most of them were Hasidic background. So to this day, they daven Nusach Sfard. But if you look on page 89, something interesting, that it says Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who's a Rosh Yeshiva there, said that when he was there, Mikevan Shemamon HaYeshiva Bamayat Sibur V'Him Kispei Tzedakah, since the Yeshiva is supported by Tzedakah, money, Asur lahem hotzi mamon ha'ocha glak kosher. That Rav Yaakov ruled that it's forbidden for the yeshiva to buy glak kosher, because glak kosher, we're not talking about today, none of us, or most of us, we don't care about glak kosher, but what we want is reliable kosher. It just so happens that it seems that out there, the only meat that's reliable is called glak. If the OU would have taken the Hebrew National contract, we'd eat that. It's not a problem. But the in a time when you still had reliable under Hashkacha, I mean, the OU until the 80s, I think it was giving Hashkacha to regular meat. Rav Yaakov said it's usur because you're taking money to buy something that's only a chumrah. Then he says that, but he would recommend to the members of the Kollel, who he thought that they should be on a higher level, that they should buy on their own glak kosher, and then, and this gives you a sense of the change in American Orthodoxy. And I call kavod to Torah Vadas for including this. It says that this changed. Why? Because the Bacharim Hirgishu Shloba Noach. He says that the Bachars at the yeshiva didn't like what Rav Yaakov said to them. They didn't feel proper eating regular kosher. And so it changed because the Talmidim wanted to be more pious. So that's a sense of what was happening, I guess, in the late 70s, maybe early 80s, that the yeshiva students felt that they wanted to change, and they overruled Rav Yaakov. They refused to eat the regular kosher. So that's a sign of the changing in the American Orthodox community. Two more things. Ruvain from Paris sent me something interesting. A number of you, I can tell from the emails, are still interested in this business with the fast days and the briskers. He sent me here, we spoke about Rabbi Pollard, I think he's pronounced Pollard, the Talmud of the Brisker Rav, Rav Binyamin Pollard. And if you look in his Sefer, and thank you, Ruvain, for this, Birchas Yitzchak, page 346, he quotes Rav Simcha Zelig-Rieger, who says, it's alumnus a bit. He explains that there's two elements here. There's the fast, because people ask, well, how could you be so lenient? This comes from the Nevi'im. They were metaking these fast days. Rav Simcha Zelig claims that the 4 days that we fast, not Yom Kippur, were established by Nevi'im that these are special days. However, the tainis, the fast days, that comes from the sages. That is, the prophets established a special day that we have to recognize, but the Tanis is not from the prophets. The Tanis is something separate. So there's two elements here, he says. There's the Kviyas Yom HaMora, that establishing a special day, and then it's the rabbis who determine what to do in that special day, and that's why the fast day has the status not of from the prophets, but of the rabbis. And therefore, since these fast days are rabbinic, you can find more leniencies. And finally, one person emailed me. We spoke about Rav Avraham Yosef, his ex Rav Avraham Yosef. I spoke about Koisha last class, and the view that you can see Rav Moshe Lichtenstein explaining, which was an older view in the Orthodox community. When I say old, it's an old view, but it's not really accepted very much anymore, that it's not an absolute prohibition. It's only if it's enticing. That is, Hir Hor is separate from Koisha. There's this understanding that Koisha applies always when you're reading Kriya Shema. But getting thoughts of Hir Hor, that's a totally separate issue, and that's just dependent on that, whether there's a hero or not. So someone emailed me, well, was that the reason? And I'm not going to mention his name. In general, I mention the people's names, unless you specifically ask me not to. He asked me, was it based on this that we know that certain Gedolim went to the opera? Okay, well, first I have to say, I don't know of any Gedolim who went to the opera. I don't know for sure. They say Rav Soloveitchik did or Futner. I don't know, though. I wasn't there, I can't say. I don't know why. There are plenty of rabbis who went to the opera, that's for sure. And in Germany, German Orthodox community, they all went to the opera. They didn't see anything wrong with this. I'll even show you more than this. Let me pull something up for you here. Find it here. Ah, I don't know if any of you recognize this woman. This woman, here you can read, I wrote about her, Rosa Olitska, her father was the chazan of the separatist community in Frankfurt. And she was an Orthodox woman, and she was a big opera person, world renowned. You can Google her. You can even buy tapes of her today. She died in 1949. This is a picture of her from when she played Carmen. So you might say, so what? What's the big deal? Yeah, people do things all the time, maybe not necessarily in line with what they're supposed to do. No, the Orthodox newspaper in Frankfurt, the Israelit, and that's not a liberal Orthodox, that's the extremist Orthodox in Germany, they wrote about her. And in Germany, the Orthodox would, go into the opera was considered standard, and it wasn't a problem. Furthermore, and I'll just add this as well, if you look in Simcha Asaf's book on Ha'on Shinachar Echatimah to Talmud, he has a takana from Hamburg, Tuf Peivav. See, Tuf Resh Peivav is 1926. So 1726, it says that no man or woman should go to the opera, only be Bimei Hanukkah and V'Shavua Shachal Bo Purim. So we see this isn't a new thing, only of going to the operas, this was part in the German Orthodox community. They say that Hirsch went to the opera, but I don't know if that's true. I asked Professor Mordechai Breuer, the great authority, the great grandson of Hirsch, and he never saw anywhere that Hirsch went to the opera, but he's told me that he went to the opera when he was young, and his father, Yitzhak Breuer, had no problem with it, because as I said, that was pretty standard in Germany. And there's more we could say about that as well. Okay, well, let us, there's a lot to say, and I want to show you some fascinating stuff today. So I want to make sure we have enough time. So let's pick up. Well, one more thing I see I have. And Nachum Shmaryahu reminds me that when we were speaking about the women's hair covering issue, I forgot to mention, I told you I would, Rav Shalom Messas. This takes us back to Siman Chavvav in the book. Where he just adds on to the end of a different tshuva that we dealt with, where he rejects his cousin, Rav Yosef Messas, and he says that it's definitely forbidden. And I skipped another tshuva that dealt with this because it doesn't really add anything. It just says it's forbidden. That's in the Sefer, let's see, what tshuva is this? It is, yes, number Samach Gimbal, Rabbi Sharvit. Okay, but now we're up to an interesting issue, which I need to give you some background about before we go further. We're up to Simon Samach Zion, and the title of it is that we have to be careful to have a mechitza between men and women for tzniut. And the tshuva that we're going to be looking at, we return to this Rav we've seen a few times. Let me find him here. Here he is. Rav Yitzhak Rassabi, who's a leading Yemenite rabbi. I'll explain to you why he wrote about this in a second. Let me close this up here for a second here. And let me give you a little bit of background here. This has to take us back a little bit. I've told people sometimes, because what we're going to be dealing with is not just a mechitza between men and women, but also dancing. Dancing, mixed dancing of a sort. We'll see exactly what. And I've often told people that, and they don't believe me until I show them the video, that at certain Hasidic weddings, not all Hasidim, but certain Hasidic weddings, there is mixed dancing. And of course, no one believes me when I tell them this. And I'm sure the people listening right now, you don't believe me. Hasidic weddings, mixed dancing. So before we even go further, I'm going to show you some videos so you can believe me. And then we'll move on and see why this is relevant to everything we're speaking about. Before that, even, I can tell you that I did a number of posts where I dealt with the issue of dancing. I'll share some of this material with you. So I went and I searched on all my old posts and I came up with a couple of things. I'll just show you because I think you'll find it of interest, and then we'll get into the issue per se that Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin deals with, and also Rabbi Rassabi. Rabbi Rassabi's response is in opposition to Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin's more liberal opinion. So let me show you a couple of things. Some of you might have seen a couple of the things I'm going to mention already. In general, let me make a principle. I repeat sometimes stories. And if you've been with me for 10 years, like David Eisen and others, you've heard them a number of times. To this, I can only say, well, maybe it gets better with age. Or we have a lot of people who've never heard them before. They're new with us. So I have to repeat them. But before I get to that, here's an interesting example. This is if you go to the website of, I have to actually close this because I have to then reopen with sound, of Yeshivas Kisei Rachamim. You have here Rabbi Eliel Madar. There's actually a responsum from him. He's one of the rabbis at Yeshivas Kisei Rachamim in the book. And to show you how out of touch with the larger world, maybe it's a good thing they are, I just want you to listen to the song that begins before the shiur starts. Most of us will recognize this, but we have people listening to us right now from Lakewood, from Litvisha places. We have from Israel, we have Hasidim. So you take my word for it. Those of you who hear this, if you don't know what it is, most of us listening will know, but the people in the yeshiva have no clue. I don't know where they got the tune from. And it relates to the word dancing, but I think you'll find this of interest. So you open it up, you want to hear a shiur on, everything you need to know about Chol HaMoed. Is it Chol or is it Moed? Because it has both aspects. So listen to this. And then he starts in with the shiur. So it's like if they knew where that was coming from, a woman singer also, I think. Well, it's Abba, so it's both. That's the first thing that came up in my searches. The second thing that came up, I played this once before, but I'll just, for those who haven't seen it, because it's right before Rosh Hashanah. And years ago, I had a whole back and forth about this, because this is also a dancing, of a different sort of dancing. But what I'm going to show you now doesn't sit well with me. Because look, we're going to be in Shul Rosh Hashanah soon. It's going to be more an abridged davening, at least where I am. They're saying 2 hours, 15 minutes. Rav Schechter has come out with his rulings that he says, if you want, you can only do the 60 tekiyas. You know, the 60 are the obligatory ones. The other ones at the end are a minhag, which is why I never really understand when they say you can't talk to the end of davening, because once you finish the 60, then you're okay. He also says, I know a lot of people will be happy with this. I assume your shul's a follow. You don't need to do Am Natzeach seven times. I never understood why. One time, he says in the English, in the Hebrew, he says even you don't have to do it one time. They're going to take out certain piyutim. But in general, we would go, we'd spend a long time in shul, and that's what we're supposed to do on Rosh Hashanah, and certainly on Yom Kippur. It's not our normal way, but we do it a couple of times a year. Many of you have heard my vort that the worst thing that the conservative movement, probably what has led to its downfall, was its members come to show on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I think I said it's the best thing if the conservative movement would cancel show on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. For what do I mean by that? I'm only half tongue in cheek, because they come to show only twice or three times a year, and then they see this is what Judaism is about. It's long days in the synagogue, Rosh Hashanah, the whole fasting, and they think that's what Judaism's about. Well, if I grew up thinking that was what Judaism's about, just fasting and long synagogue, then I wouldn't want to be part of it either. I notice they're so mocked in Yom Kippur, they always wear the shoes. They look at us with the sneakers, they think that we're not respectful. But if they want to come to shul twice a year, you come on Simchas Torah, come on Shabbos. Shabbos is even more important than Rosh Hashanah, and in some ways more important than Yom Kippur. But you know, Judaism is not about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. These are like exceptions. We have to do them, and there's important reasons, but it's not like we're not ascetic. We're not hermits or monks or anything like that. And people in the conservative movement get the wrong impression of what Judaism is, unfortunately. But the opposite way is also crazy. And let me just play you. This is from Eishet Torah. And I don't know, maybe I'm just out of touch, but it really bothers me because there's no, sh I mean, that people are supposed to think that on Rosh Hashanah you're supposed to break dance to non-Jewish music, but here it is.
So what are you going to do for Rosh Hashanah?
Oops.
Look, I'm all for New Year's parties, but the Jewish New Year, I mean, it's just going to be a bunch of guys praying, right? What's the fun in that?
It's the holiest time of the year, a time for introspection, appreciation, and you know what? Let me explain to you a little bit differently. Guys, let's go!
Okay, might be good music and everything, but what this has to do with Rosh Hashanah? Nothing, not at all, and whatever. Okay, so I'm going to show you something now, Hasidic mixed dancing. The first time I ever saw this was I was a waiter. For those who are from the New York area, you might remember there was a place called Simcha by the Sea. Simcha by the Sea was a catering hall in Staten Island, and it was on the water. It was an old like a nursing home that they turned into a hotel, and you could go there for a wedding. Oh, they didn't have weddings. Sheva brachos they would have, and bar mitzvahs, and that's mostly what it was. And the whole frum crowd came. What today we call the Haredim. It was run by a man named Shimon Newhouse, or by Shimon Newhouse, who's an old-time Lakewood guy. He goes back to the 1950s, and I got to be quite close with him. But it was all out of JC people. I used to learn with him even. That's how I got close to him. And everyone used to come. Rav Schwartzman came. Rav Schwartz, once I remember, he came. I got to speak to him. He was the son-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler. Hold on, by the way. In a few weeks, you'll see my new blog post. You'll see who Rav Aaron Cutler really wanted to be his son-in-law. This will blow you away when you see this. And it didn't work out because he was a total yeshivish person. And Ravaron's daughter was, she was going to Columbia to get a PhD in political science. She was a delegate to the Democratic National Convention. On my trip to Morocco last January, someone was on the trip who knew her because she worked with her on the McGovern campaign, if you can believe it. This woman, by the way, Ravaron Cutler's daughter and Ravaron Cutler's widow would come to the hotel every single Shabbos. And I was their waiter usually, but I didn't know who she was really. I knew she was, but I didn't know how, you know, intellectual she was and everything. Otherwise, I would have spoke and got great stories from her. So this was a catering facility, not under any hashgacha, by the way. I've said this before. I Googled it, and here's from the Jewish Observer. Here's an ad for it from 1981. It says highest standard of kashrus. There was no hashgacha, no mashgiach at all. Everyone relied on Rabbi Newhouse. I don't know if you could do that today, no matter who you were. But that's the old way of doing things. Like they used to do when you had an inn or something like that. You'd, if the guy, so no hashgacha. And then I started working at weddings with him. And I came back from a wedding. This is when I was a senior in high school. We used to do weddings during Sunday nights and also during the week at a number of different places, including there was a place in Staten Island called the Shalimar and a number of others. Those had a mashgichim, obviously, because they had to kasher it. But at the hotel, there was no mashgiach. It's like if you have a kiddush at your shul, you don't have a mashgiach. The shul's the kiddush. So that's that was that. Unfortunately, Rabbi Newhouse passed away a number of years ago already. So I came back and I told my Rebbe, his Rebbe was Rabbi Parnas, Yehuda Parnas from YU's son, Michal Parnas. I told him what I saw and what I'm going to show you. And first of all, it blew me away because I'd never seen anything like that. And he says, oh, it's an old dispute between the Misnagdim and the Hasidim. And I've subsequently learned that it's actually a dispute among the Hasidim themselves. So, okay, so now that I whet your appetite, I tell you, you're going to see mixed dancing at Hasidic weddings of the bride and the groom, just like the first dance, and also the father and the daughter. I could give you a lot of them. In fact, two of the best ones I had, which went really wild. The ones you see are pretty calm, have been placed private for whatever reason. So here we go. What do I have here? Okay, so this is a father and daughter. Okay, you might say no big deal, father and daughter. But I'm going to show you now husbands and wives. And I could see someone saying it's better if all the men were dancing with their wives because now they're watching the bride. And that's the whole point. You're not supposed to. But here, you don't believe there's mixed dancing on Seder Shul weddings? This is Ellie's mitzvah dance from mitzvah. That's what they call it, the mitzvah dance. You can Google this yourself. Here's Gitti's wedding. They do this at the end of the wedding. So that's what we're not dealing with. It's pretty calm, as you can see. But this is one I found. They want to know, is this bad or not? Look at the question. Okay, so there you see. A couple others. Here's the Chassan and Kala Mitzvah Town. And now let me show you one of the with the Bubba for Rebbe in it. It's his granddaughter. Someone in the first comment says they both have the demeanor of people going to a funeral, not a wedding. But okay. The point is that here you have dancing, bride and groom dancing. Very strange because we're told you're not supposed to have that. But is that true? Has this never happened? So that's the issue we have to deal with now and get into the tshuva of Rabbi Yehuda Hankin first. The issue, obviously, is you're watching the bride dance. You might be thinking, well, wait a second, does the Mishnah and Tanis tell you that the young women would go out there and dance in front of the men? It says on Tu B'Av and Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, some people think it's a mistake. It doesn't really mean that, but definitely Tu B'Av. Okay, so you can come up with all sorts of reasons that these are, they're looking for husbands, although today that would never happen. But still, here you're looking at married women. Incidentally, since we mentioned Rabbi Abadi a few times, if you look in his volume 2 of Or Yitzchak, page 251, he says that a number of years ago, I was at a wedding with Rabbi Schwab, and there wasn't a machitza. And when they began to dance, he left the room. And I went after him and I asked him, well, why do we have, I asked him, what about the Gemara in Tainis that says that the women would dance? Rabbi Schwab left because the women were dancing in front of him. And Rabbi Schwab answered, what kind of comparison is that? He says, Shama lo rak yu kemosh rok di mayom. He said, then in the days of the temple, they didn't dance like they do today, the fast simcha dancing. He says, but they would go in a circle and just go around. And that there's no lack of tzniut in a circle. So you see two interesting things here. The Rabbi Schwab is saying that dancing in a circle, that's not unsneistic. And the fact that there wasn't the machitza, that's also an interesting point. Because you go to weddings today, we'll see what Rabbi Henkin says in a minute, but a lot of the weddings, they have machitza. But really, there's no point for them. What's the point of the machitza? The point of the machitza is that the men don't see the women dancing. But half these weddings, the men are sitting. It's not like the men and women are sitting separately. Men and women are sitting together. So you have the men sitting on the side of the machitza where the women dancing. So tell me, what's the point of the machitza? Is it just symbolic? It has no point because the men are sitting on the side. Unless you're going to say the men get up and go to the other side, which they don't do, because half of them don't want to dance. They sit there. Okay, so I want to talk about the tshuva of Rabbi Rashabi. There's more. You can look at one of my blog posts. I can tell you, you can just Google Mark Shapiro engaged couples. And I deal a lot with different practices that you might at weddings that you would find strange today. Bride and groom touching before the wedding, bride, groom holding the bride's hand, bring her down to the wedding. Rabbis bringing brides in, holding onto their gowns, all sorts of interesting things that we would not do today. But so Rabbi Rashabi's tshuva is directed against Rabbi Yehuda Ratz Henkin. So first I need to go through with you Rabbi Henkin says to know what's the response. Rabbi Yehuda Ratz Henkin, someone we've dealt with already many times. If you look in his B'nai Vanim, volume 1, number 37, he has a very, very long responsa. It's double column, and it's 15 pages, double column. It's called Hilchot Rikudim. And also, if there's a problem with circular dancing, he begins the responsa that he's writing to a certain rabbi who said that a woman can't dance so that men can see. Actually, if you're dancing with your wife, you can't dance so everyone can see. And Rabbi Henkin says he has a problem or a difficulty raises that we have many examples of takanot. We'll get to these in a second, where they say that a man should only dance with his wife. That is, don't dance with anyone else. So before we understand what this means, already we see that great rabbis were issuing ordinances that men could only dance with their wives, which means that they were dancing. We're talking public dancing. So how could you say it's forbidden? And then he gets into the issue of because this person thought it would be unsneeze for a man and a woman to dance that you can see them. And he doesn't accept that. And he says that he gives examples of the things from Tanakh. He says that you see a brother and a sister, like if they're holding hands and if they're. Actually, no, I didn't say holding hands. He just says he gives examples that certain things, people you see, there's no here or, like a father and a daughter, brother, sister. And then he says, why am I elaborating on this? He goes on, he says that you have to distinguish between the earlier dancing and today's dancing, where it's a different type. But we don't need to get involved with that now. We'll see that a little bit later. But then he says that I need to elaborate on this because someone claimed that he was at a wedding 40 years ago of a Rosh Hashiva, and with the daughter of the head of the yeshiva, so we can maybe figure out who this was, that is the founder of the yeshiva and his daughter married the Rosh Yeshiva. And after the meal, they made an announcement about the dancing, Ko ishi mishto atoralov, that only that husbands and wives can now dance. And he says it was very strange that to me, Rabbi Henkin says, that this would be done at a rabbinic gathering, and we don't have any proof other than this person said it, but he says, Bikaro nirish inu asur. Rabbi Henkin says it appears that although it might be distasteful, it's not forbidden. What's the problem We're not talking like dirty dancing or those. So we're just talking like a regular type of slow dancing. He doesn't see what the issue was. Now, whether such a thing ever happened, it's hard for me to imagine it happened at a yeshiva dinner. At shul dinners, of course it happened. All the young Israels and the modern Orthodox shuls would do that. In my shul, in West Orange, New Jersey, they had to dance every year until the rabbi was honored once. I guess this was about 1980 or so. And since all his rabbinic friends were coming, he asked that there only be Jewish dancing at the dinner, and which there were. And it never, after that, it never continued. They never returned to the old way. But Rav Henkin's point is that we're dealing with if it's a halachic matter. And he doesn't see it's a halachic matter because what would be the halachic issue? The halachic issue that he's responding to is the person says, when people see you dancing with your wife, it's unsnias to. And Rav Henkin brings all sorts of proofs that he doesn't see why it's unsnias. And then he says, even to lechoz bal b'yidei ishto b'alicha b'rachof, he says, even for a Talmud Chacham to hold hands with his wife walking down the street, It's not a question of sneeves. Granted, for the Gerah Hasidim, the women walk behind them. But for other people, he says, even for rabbis, it's not a question of unsneeves. So he says, if it's not a question of unsneeves, and he says that he doesn't see just a slow dance, why it's lack of sneeves. When they say lack of sneeves, it means people will start having inappropriate thoughts. He doesn't see it. And incidentally, if you're going to say it's a problem and you will have these impure thoughts, then all these mitzvah counts that happen at the end of the Hasidic weddings, they're even worse. Because at least when everyone's dancing together, they're looking at their partner. You saw those videos. Everyone is staring at the bride. At least I think they're staring at the bride. I don't think they're staring at the groom. I mean, the men looking over there. So that's, how could that be? So if you're going to say it's by definition, it's a problem, you can cite that as a source. So he goes on and they're very interesting. Already you can see that this is like a liberal tshuva. So you can imagine what Rav Tzabi is going to say about this. And then he continues in section 3 that he talks about dancing, the old dancing with a handkerchief, which again, it's the same issue, because what's the difference, handkerchief or not? He wants to deal with that, and then circle dancing. He says he thinks that it's a problem having a circle where the women are inside and the men are on the outside, and he thinks it's pritzut to go in and out of the circle, but he says, "B'magal nashim levad, b'tzad magal dvarim levad, minayim lesor." But he doesn't see any problem when you have a circle, women's circle on one side, men's circle on the other side, no machitza, because he doesn't see it as an unsneas thing. And then he says, and if you're going to tell me it's a problem to look at the women, he says, that's all times to look at them, but it's mitzad anashim. That, you know, it's from the standpoint of the men, they have to look, and if it's a problem for them, but that's not an issue in the dancing per se, that's just an issue in men, when it's appropriate, when it's not. And then he says, but if the men are dancing on their own, then what, he doesn't see it's a problem. Basically, he's defending, he says, this happens all the time. We have the chasanas, the b'nei yeshiva, talmid chachamim, where women are dancing and men are dancing. His argument basically is to establish Jewish dancing in the same room without a machitza. And yes, you're going to say the women are dancing there. So his whole point is, well, then don't look at them. That's his point. And if it's a slow, and he doesn't see it's a problem. And then he cites that we see that, and if you see women dancing, who says it's a problem automatically? He says that women went out in circles to greet Shaul and David in Sefer Shmuel. And he wants to say that, basically, this is sort of, you have to know yourself. He quotes the Ritva. The Ritva says that Isser Histaklut, the prohibition to stare at women, Toloi Lefi Masha Adam Makir Ba'atzmo. It depends on each person individually, that they know what's appropriate and what's not. And Halko Lefi Masha Eno Vroos, and if you're able to control yourself, you can speak to them and you can look at them, et cetera, et cetera. Just a famous ritva. And then he gets in. So this is all of interest. We'll see what Rav Tzabi says about this. But then and he concludes that section. When a matter is so spread, like dancing we have today in separate circles, He says that basically you can rely, it's not a problem, everyone does. Then he gets into section 5. And here's where it gets historically interesting. He says, this is what's really difficult, he says. He says, Kasha Mizeh, more difficult than what we've seen, is Takanot of Chachmei Padua. These Takanot were published, you don't only need Takanot Padua, there's a lot of Takanot like this. Padua is a great Italian city in Italy, about a little less than an hour south of Venice. And in the 15th century, the rabbis of Padua, including the great Mari Mintz, his grandson was Maram Padua, Mari Mintz from Yehuda Mintz, they signed an ordinance, a takana, and the takana says as follows. Gam gazarnu, we decreed, shaloyakdu, im hanashi manasua, shum zachar, im nekeva nasua, that no man is to dance with a married woman except on Purim. He's going to explain how could you even do this on Purim. Amnam imapnuyos, yochlu your code. But you can dance, that is, single men and single women can dance. Whether this is touching or not, it's not clear in it. It could be that it's not, but it says they could dance. And what's the Tanai? On the condition that the men are dressed in an appropriate way and everything is covered up properly. I'm thinking it's not touching. I think it's like the old dancing. Because touching would be a problem. Now, this is signed by Mari Mintz and three of his other rabbis. So how to explain this? First, let me tell you that Rabbi Henkin immediately says that this is the Shita of the Mari Mintz. Mari Mintz has a ruling. Well, let me tell you about a little bit of the Mari Mintz, and then I'll tell you about his famous ruling, his most famous ruling. He was Rav in Padua for 47 years. He was the most prominent rabbi in Italy of his time. In fact, in 1505, he made Birkas HaChama when he was over 100 years old. So what would that be? I don't know how many times it is. We know that they were three or four. So they were four times. So they were, I think, three times, I guess. They were having discussions when he made it, how many times he made it. Now his most famous psak, and the one Rav Henkin refers to, is he permits cross-dressing on Purim. You can look in the Shulchan Aruch, the Rama quotes this halacha lemaisa, that although cross-dressing, it's a Torah prohibition to cross-dress, and yet the Rama quotes the Yehuda Mintz that says on Purim, you are allowed to. Because it's you're not doing it for any reason other than simcha. So Rabbi Henkin says, this is the same thing if you're going to dance with a married woman on Purim. Rabbi Henkin says, you're not doing it for immoral reasons, you're doing it for simcha. And just like Mari Mintz permits cross-dressing on Purim because it's done for simcha, even though it's a Torah violation, so too he permits married men with other married women to dance. I happen to agree with Rabbi Ratzabi's critique, as we'll see in a minute, of what Rabbi Henkin says here. He permits them to dance just on Purim. The issue of the unmarried one, we'll get to that in a second. Let me just tell you more about, although this is the Mari Mintz's most famous psak, his most influential psak is something else. He's the one that first rules, and this is where it all comes from, that it's recorded by the Rama and the Shulchan Aruch, if there's two Adars. What happens if you're born in Adar, and in your bar mitzvah year, there's two Adars? He says that you're regarded as bar mitzvah in the second Adar, which is the regular Adar, and the first Adar is the one that's added. And that's, I assume that's what we go by, because that's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. In his tshuva, he actually, in his tshuva, he has a riddle. He says as follows. Reuven was born before Shimon. How is it possible that Shimon will be bar mitzvah before Reuven, if Reuven is born before Shimon? And he says if they're both born in a leap year, Reuven is born at the end of Adar 1 and Shimon at the beginning of Adar 2. So as Reuven is born before Shimon, but in the bar mitzvah year, there's only one Adar. So lo and behold, Shimon is bar mitzvah before Reuven, even though he's born after. And his yeshiva in Padua, there's also a university there. People went, he had medical doctors there, but it attracted students all over. So let's continue with the tshuva there. And Rabbi Henkin goes further. He said, he quotes Rabbi Mintz, Yehuda Mintz, as he quotes another proof that on Purim, things basically have a carnival-like atmosphere. That Rabbi Yehuda Mintz quotes Rishon as saying that the children or young people, Bahurim, running around, you're allowed to grab someone's food. Like if I'm sitting down here and I'm about to eat a hamantaschen, someone can come over and grab it and start eating it. And even though it's mine and I bought it with my own money, he doesn't need to pay me back because it's Purim and it's part of the Simcha. And in the Moroccan communities, they had a tradition of you do similar things like this and you don't need to pay back. How could you not pay back? It's gezeila. It's thievery. I bought it. He took it. I never gave him permission. And Mari Mintz thinks that I'm Purim, sort of the regular rules are put in abeyance to a certain extent. Mishum Simchas Purim, Hachinami Benido Dedan, Lo Shna. He says, so too, Rabbi Henkin says, in our case, the man dancing with the married woman, Kevon She'eno Machavein Laniuch, Ela Simchas Purim. Since you're dancing with the married woman, you don't have in mind immoral things, just Simcha Purim. I mean, who says he doesn't have in mind immoral things? But that's what he says. That's what Henkin says. But and he says, since they didn't make a geder about gezeila, so too here. And then he elaborates that this is all part, he's trying to show that dancing per se, he's not saying there should be mixed dancing, any of that. He doesn't say that. But he wants to show that from a pure halachic standpoint, men and women could dance and have danced. And you can't say, you really, it's hard to say it's forbidden. It sort of has to be policy. And today you could say that the dancing is different, so we can forbid it based on that. But the simple idea that you can't see a man and a woman dancing, he says, we have all these, he cites different shuvas, Binyam and Zev, and there's Rav David of Corfu and others that speak about takanot they made explaining how the community should dance. And since we see they were doing it, therefore, you can't judge it as the way people often judge it. Okay, this is interesting, obviously. But let's see now what Rav Rasavi says. I wrote to Rav Rasavi because he has a response to him about the same issue. And he doesn't mention any of these points, and I was curious to see what he would say. And he replies as follows. This is a responsum that appeared in his Sefer, Olas Yitzchak, Volume 2, and this is from 1991. He begins, Heitev Charali, Eichan Heita Zotara. Such anger I have. How does this terrible thing happen? Sha'adam Muhtar Bechetar Torah. A person who's regarded as a rabbi, you know, that he's able to come up with such hevel, he calls it, such nonsense. To permit that which is forbidden. Rikud nashim bifnei nashim, minale hayetera. Where can he get this idea that women can dance in front of men? And then he says, even if there's a, you can find the permission. Afilim hayetzarachat shalheter. Nevertheless, hayaroi lidar geder. It's best to make a geder, a fence. Why? Because the door is porous. Because in today's day and age, we know what people are like. How could, he says, Ech yavo, Talmud Chacham, will take Yad Laposhim. How can a Talmud Chacham, like Rabbi Henkin, come and give an opening for sinners? Oy lo oita chlima, woe to such disgrace. And then he says, all of his proofs can be rejected. And I'm not going to spend much time doing it. I don't want to spend time with Vatel Devarim Betelim to, you know, to... I refute his Dvarim B'Tehillim, his nonsensical matters. This Rabbi Henkin saw this tshuva, and he wrote to me because he wanted to contact Rabbi Rasabi, and he did. And Rabbi Rasabi is very into Moritza, and Rabbi Henkin, in his letter to him, says, although I'm not Moshav Meilitzin. It's a play on Moshav Leitzin, a place where the scoffers sit. He says, Moshav Meilitzin, he defended himself. And I have to tell you, despite the strong language of Rasabi, at the end, as they say, that there was peace because they were able to, not to say that they agreed, but it's always easy to write about someone until you get to know them a bit. But then he says, so let me... I can't just not say anything. He begins by citing, it's a Hasidic Rebbe, Reb Mordechai M. Navorna, that when he did a wedding, the women, only the women would do the mitzvah tants, and they commanded the men not to look at it. So don't bring me mitzvah tants, because he doesn't think that that's permissible. And then he gets into the issue, though, of the tachanot of Chachmei Padua, and the other cities. We have lots of these takanot. And I have to say that I actually agree with Rav Ratzabi's point. I think, I'm not sure. Remember, it said that you can't dance with married women except on Purim, and the other times only the single people could dance. He says, doesn't he realize that the rabbis couldn't forbid everything? There was a lot of pressure for them on by their communities, especially in Italy, where dancing was a big deal. She'im yasru et kol ha'asur, if they're going to forbid everything, lo yishmu lam klum. People will not listen at all. Therefore, they began with the smaller matters. I mean, with the bigger matters, the most important. The rabbis were forced to compromise. And I'm sympathetic to what he's saying from a historical standpoint. Do you think all the shuls where they had dances, the rabbis for the young people, the rabbis really thought this was 100% kosher? No, but the compromise they made was, and the Young Israel movement in the 1930s, 40s, if you don't, 50s going on even, if you don't let them dance in the shul where they can meet boys and Jewish boys and girls, they're going to go to the clubs. So they're not saying that it's a l'chatchila, they're saying it's a b'diavad. It's the best we can do under the circumstances. So Rabbi Henkin sees the takanot in Padua and elsewhere, where it's saying that don't dance with anyone else, but just on Purim, and the single people can't dance with married people; they can only dance with single people. So Rabbi Henkin sees this. Well, it obviously isn't so forbidden. And Rabbi Ratzabi says not true at all. Now Rabbi Henkin, in his response, says if it really was regarded as so forbidden, and how could they have permitted it, especially with the married woman? But Rabbi Rasabi thinks it's just an example of the, and I'm sympathetic to what he's saying, maybe because it's hard for me to imagine that the great rabbis would have ever, they have to know the circumstances they were in. The people wanted to do this sort of thing. So the community makes decrees. I think it's true. What are they going to say? You can't have any dancing? The people wanted dancing. So you give them as much as you can. The rabbis didn't like playing cards either. They hated card playing, but they knew they couldn't forbid it because people would play it anyway. So they always allowed card playing, let's say, around Hanukkah time. And then they would continue it for a few weeks after Hanukkah, and then they would forbid it again. And if you played cards, you would be put in cheirem, or they would fine you, or you couldn't get an aliyah and shul, all sorts of things. Did the rabbis like cards? No, they felt cards were a waste of time, a moshav leitzim, all these things. But what are you going to do? People want it. So the way Rav Ratzabi sees the matter really follows what we know about takanot, that we saw the opera takanot. If it was absolutely forbidden to go to the opera, I don't know. Maybe would they have allowed them to go in the takana we saw? Maybe yes, but even quite apart from that, it's not a place they want Jews going with the non-Jews to the opera, leaving aside any strict halachic issues. But the people are pressuring the rabbis, so you have to make compromises. It happens all the time. I actually think the Rav Tzabi is correct on this matter, that and Rabbi Henkin never deals with the real issue of the single people dancing. I get it. Husband and wife dancing, fine. That's you can easily find a way to justify it. If you can watch the bride and groom dance, as we just saw, you can, everyone else doing it. But how could a man dance with a married woman, even on Purim? And you're going to say, well, how could you cross-dress? I think it's sort of different. In my own opinion, I think it's different. Cross-dressing depends on what your kavana is. If you're just doing it for simcha, not to make believe you look like a woman, so you could say it's permissible. Why are you dancing? You're dancing because you enjoy dancing. What do you mean? You're dancing because of simcha Purim? If you want to dance with simcha Purim, you can find other people to dance with. You dance with your own wife. You don't got to dance with someone else's wife. It doesn't make any sense. And second of all, okay, the boys and the girls dancing. It could be the dancing like square dancing or just slow back and forth without any touching or anything. So really, maybe not such a big deal from a pure halachic thing. But still, it's you can easily imagine the rabbis feeling they have to do something. And without getting into details, I've discussed in the past, there were communities that did a lot more to keep Jews from sinning. They did stuff to keep Jews from going. We spoke about it in the Shanghai classes. There's certain takanot they made, I won't get into them now, about to prevent men from going to non-Jewish prostitutes and things they did. And you're going to say that means they supported, they thought it was permissible? No. But the Gemara already says, if you're going to sin, go to a place where they don't know you and put on black. It doesn't mean that that's permissible, but it means if you're going to do it anyway, that's the best way. So I really think that Rav Arsabi is correct historically on this matter. And at the end of the tshuva, he quotes another interesting thing. This just after he uses very strong language against Rav Henkin. He says, but at the end, he a totally different issue. He quotes the Maharil. The Maharil is Rav Yaakov Modlin. We see his grave on our Germany trips. Where do we see it? In Worms, I think it was, or in Mainz, I forget now. He's the founder of Ashkenazic Minhag. He was a chazan. The Nusach that we have apparently goes back to, or at least it's attributed to him. If you look in Hilchos Nesuin, he says, the Maharil says that the kala, when the kala is brought to the chuppah, the husband holds her hand. So they would have a thing, not like us, where they come down, the father, the groom, and then the parent. Well, I shouldn't say the different customs. I've seen it where both fathers, when I worked at this catering hall, I saw all sorts of things. Sometimes you have both fathers bring the son down and both mothers bring the kala down. But the Maharil says that that could be like you've seen perhaps where the father and mother of the bride bring her in, and then the chassan goes and takes her by her hand and brings her to the actual chuppah. People, I'm sure, would say it's unsneistic, but that's what the it says that the they used to do in the days of the Maharil. And Rav Arsabi says some Ashkenazim do this also. I've never seen this at a Haredi wedding. But he says that in our circles, such as where the Yemenite circles, this would be regarded as pritzus to do this in front of everyone. But he says it's not technically forbidden. And then he continues and says that a man and woman shouldn't be public displays of affection, et cetera, et cetera. He mentions this because of what Rabbi Henkin spoke about, public displays. And then he concludes, we see from this that it's Isur Chamor, Biros Barikur Nashim. It's a strong prohibition to see the women dancing. And from here, Chova Motelis Al Rosh Hayam Kodesh, he says that the rabbis have to make sure that you have to have completely closed mechitza so that you do not see them. Unlike the machitzas that most of our weddings have, where the men sit on the other side. So that's what Rabbi Arsabi says. I think you might find this interesting as well. I wrote about this in one of my blog posts that there's a Rabbi Yisrael David Margulis. He cites that, first of all, the Maharil says that the rabbi would actually bring the bride to the groom, holding her by her robe. That would be regarded as problematic today. So the Maharil says the rabbi would bring the bride, holding her by her robe or wedding gown, and then give her to the groom. And the groom, holding her hand, would then go to where the chuppah is. Rabbi Yisrael David Margulis says, how could you possibly do this? Where's the sneus? And he answers, probably correctly, he says that the typical bride in those days, in the days of the Maharil, was under 12 years old. And he says that we don't expect people to have any impure thoughts. He says, "Eze hirhur ye bekala katano nara kazos." He says, you're not going to have such hirurim. The Rav would take her himself from the house, and he would bring her to the chassan. Avraham Grossman agrees with the fact that in medieval times, the women were very young. He even uses this to explain a problematic thing, which we have a tshuva about in the book a little later on. We know, unfortunately, just like you're told that, where they say shikar is a guy, that the Jews didn't get drunk, and that's a non-Jewish trait. Well, some Jews did get drunk, although it wasn't the level of others, we've had it. And the same thing is, we've had examples of wife beaters. We have lots of examples in the tshuva literature that speak about it. Obviously a terrible thing, but to make believe it never happened isn't correct. Grossman, Avram Grossman, who's perhaps the, definitely the leading scholar of Ashkenazic Jewry. He's written on Chachmei Ashkenaz Rishonim, Chachmei Tzarfat, the French scholars, on Rashi. He has an article dealing with wife beating and how that's dealt with by the medieval rabbis. And he thinks that a lot of this probably goes back to the fact that you had young girls, 12, 11 even, even younger we have in certain times, getting married to people who were twice their age, even older than that, and three times their age. Things that today we would not approve of, but it's a different time period. Grossman says that he thinks that you probably had a situation where the husband related to the wife like a daughter, in a certain sense, that she was like a child, and that therefore, just like you might slap a child, you'd slap your wife. He wants to give that to explain it. I don't know if you need to look there to explain it. Some people are just going to be bad people, but he thinks that the age difference, and that these were children. And you read the responsa literature, the girls, they run away, they run home. I mean, it's all sorts of things. And so we know that they were young. And therefore, Rabbi Margolis explains that don't thinking today, like a 20-year-old, the rabbi is going to take the gown of the bride and pull the wedding gown, hold on to the wedding gown and bring her to the chassan, and that wouldn't be regarded as sneis. But if you're dealing with a little child, where he says, I don't know if Rabbi Margolis, when he says here about Eze Hirhor Yebekala Katano Nara Kazos, he says no one's going to have Hirhor about a young girl like that. Unfortunately, seeing today that some people do. But that's what he says. Oh, I see it's already 9:28. So let me just, before we get to the questions in the comments, let me tell you, next class we're going to, I'm going to take you into the world, a lost world of American Orthodoxy, the ADA group, what they hired me to do, and we're going to see tshuvot of a number of significant figures that deals with the role of women, more about the role of women in American Orthodoxy. And we will also, this woman, if you don't know who she is also going to play a part in it, Nechama Leibowitz. Now I see something, I'm going to take it back to you. I forgot to play it for you without non-Jewish music. I thought of it as I was preparing what I was going to say today. My friend who went to Rutgers in the 80s, we know that there are many nigunim from non-Jewish songs. One of the big Hasidic nigunim comes from a Ukrainian peasant song, and they change the lyrics. They refer to a woman to refer to God. So the love of the woman is the love of God. But we have many tunes, Simon Garfunkel and things, but my friend told me, and again, those who are old enough remember this from the 70s, and those who watch TV will remember this. My friend told me that in the 1980s at Rutgers Chabad, they had a nigun with this tune, and I think you all remember this. Oh, hold on, I got to get the, do I have the sound here? Yes, I have the computer sound. Think of a nigun with this. Yum, bumblebee, bumblebee, tuna. I love bumblebee. And so my friend told me that the Chabad rabbi didn't have a TV, obviously never heard of it. He thought it was a good nigun. And there's all sorts of stories like that. I don't know if they're true or not about different nigunim. But I see it's already time, so we have to end now. Let me look at some of the questions and comments here.
Dr. Mark, if you want for 1 second, I'll just tell you on Purim. When I was in Yeshiva de Kotel, 1980, Purim, all the chutzakim were sitting back. You know, night there's no internet. You went to Israel, nobody came home for Pesach. You know, you spoke home every 3 weeks on the phone. And we sat back on Purim, we started going, and Rav Hadari, the Rosh Yeshiva Alav HaShalom, came back, and he was so excited that we were, you know, getting involved, and he came clapping with us and, you know, singing with us, and it was a different world.
And from a Hasidic perspective, this is very good, because they believe in you can raise the sparks of these songs by providing holy content to them. There's a Beach Boys tune that's used, Shabbos Miros in Scranton, one of the families I used to eat at, Scarborough Fair, Simon and Garfunkel, they use that for one of the Nigunim. So it's not
I was doing that at KBY. They used to use Three Blind Mice for Unintana Tokef.
I don't know. That's a little strange. For
that's a person who was there told me.
On Simchas Torah.
We're talking before the Six-Day War even.
Well, on Simchas Torah, I once heard, this was in Vacation Village, Kedusha, Musaf to the sound of the Godfather. Na-na-na-na-na. But that's Simchas Torah. Now, I wouldn't do it on Shabbos. Okay, Alan says, 4 fast days. Why did the congregation in Bavel ask Zechariah? He would say perhaps he's asking not about the fast or about the day. Where Simcha Zelig was saying there's 2 things here. There's the day and then there's the fasting. That's what he says. David Eisen says, I believe that those of you who claim that all Kalisha is objectively prohibited, whether or not enticing, is based on a reading that Kobisha Erva, while those who consider prohibited only if it is enticing, is based on the additional letter, Kobisha Erva. Okay, maybe. You know, the issue of Kol Isha Erva also is where does the singing aspect come in? Kol should mean a voice. And there are people who say, basically, voices are problematic. If you want, you can email me. I'll send the link. But you can, if you just Google Mark Shapiro's foreign blog, Engaged Couples, you'll get it. In that post, I also spoke about the word Se'irim that appears in the Shulchan Aruch. No one knows what it means, Se'irim, young people. And he's referring to the certain type of Catholic priests. Someone privately asked me, didn't going to Israel start up as the right-wing conservative branch? So examples of slow mixed dancing from there, does it prove anything? Young Israel not going to Israel? I don't know what this means, young Israel start out as the right-wing conservative. No, young Israel didn't start out as right-wing conservative at all. Young Israel started out as Orthodox. The fact that Mordechai Kaplan was involved in the Young Israel doesn't mean anything. He also was rabbi at the Jewish Center and the assistant rabbi to the Ramaz. So Young Israel started out as Orthodox. It's not just Young Israel. All the modern type of Orthodox would have had dancing in those days. How widespread is the Hasidic custom of mixed dancing at their weddings? Is it a minority custom of Hasidim or most do? I don't know. I can tell you that when I did my post and I did this, someone texted me, said that this is wrong. It's only outliers. And then I quoted Sfarim that say it. So I know if we have Hasidim listen, they can tell me. I did many weddings and I did not see it at most of the Hasidic weddings. But at some of the Hasidic weddings, and it's always at the end, when most of the people are gone, but it's there, and now they're putting it on YouTube, and it's called the mitzvah tants. In the non-Orthodox circles, the mitzvah tants is something different. But that in the Hasidic, there's certain Hasidic groups that the day before the wedding, they have a suda. I think Chernobyl does this. They have a suda, and the bride and groom are there, and they do a mitzvah tants the day before the wedding, but with the string. If you go on YouTube and you plug in mitzvah tants, you'll see many examples of the mitzvah tants with the string. There's even a famous picture of Soloveitchik, which I posted, which I got from David Eisen. David Eisen is with us now. Let me see quickly if I can just, David Eisen sent it to me, and it's a picture of the Rav. If I can't pull it up very quickly now, I will send it to you. I will show it to you next class of the Rav at a wedding. I don't see it on the where the Rav is doing the mitzvah tants, with a, I'll show it to you next class, with a string. And that's, and we've even able to determine who this woman is. No one knew who it was. It actually was the sister of the rabbi of West Orange, Rabbi Alvin Marcus, and she just passed away last year. I'll show you the picture next class, unless someone knows. I posted it in a Sforim blog. Hold on, I'll make a note of this. And then since I posted it, the picture has been picked up everywhere without giving me credit, and I don't need the credit, but without giving David Eisen, our own David Eisen, listening to us, he's the one who sent it to me. But I'll show you that picture next class, and I'll talk about the picture. Someone wants to know, what's the point of denying things like mixed dancing at Hasidic weddings when there's proof like the videos? I don't think the people are denying it to deny because they're trying to cover it up. People don't believe it. When I mention it, they don't think it's possible. And I remember when I saw it, I couldn't believe it. And that's when my partner said, it's an old dispute between us. And I don't know, I'm not a Hasid, but I don't know how many Hasidic groups, but the videos I just showed you, I found them in 1 minute online. Susanna says, how is playing cards different than playing Sheshbes? Sfaradim did that all the time, at least in the movies. In the Ashkenazic world, playing cards isn't different. Dice, all these things, but these were regarded as bittul Torah, waste of time. Moshav Leitzim, where the people just gathered together. Same thing going to coffee houses, all these things. And the rabbis wanted to stop it. The fact that they made all these decrees against it shows that the people were doing it. How successful were the rabbis? That's the thing. We never know this. We have the sermons that attack it. We have the decrees. But how successful were the rabbis? They had to keep doing the decrees over and over again. It shows you they weren't that successful. It could be the Sfaradim are more laid back. But in a shtetl, in a community where the rabbis had authority, and not just the rabbis, the communal leaders, they would, remember in those days, they didn't have a computer, they didn't have TV. What are those average person supposed to do? They're not learning. This isn't an easy way of, and the real problem with it, that they would go to the non-Jewish places to play. And they really wanted to keep them from the non-Jews. But they have to have some opening. So therefore they allow them on Hanukkah time, they can do this. Shmuel says, according to Rav Sabi, the Hasidim who mixed dance, they abide in halacha, then it's completely usher, even father and daughter. Yes, completely usher, not because of negi or anything like that. It's usher for the original reason, that people are looking at the woman dancing. And that's absolutely forbidden, to look at a woman dancing. Doesn't matter if she's dancing with the father. You know, maybe actually with the father you can make, because the whole argument they say, you see her dancing, you're going to have hirhurim. Who's going to have hirhurim seeing the father dance with the daughter? But with the father, with the wife and the husband, of course it's us, sir. He says it's absolutely, yeah. Barry says he did his master's, Dr. Isaac Lewin, whose son has been with us among a number of classes, maybe even tonight, at Bernard Ravel Graduate School. He sent me to interview Professor Sarah Schwartzman, that's who I was speaking about, daughter of Aaron, and Dr. Lewin told me not to ask her the obvious question in the first interview. At the first or the third. This was Professor Schwartzman, who attended Barnard and Columbia. Hours of her on tape. She told me how the Rav of Aaron were so close. She told me her father said, Gay gesunt hate the Barnard. Her father said, go to Barnard. We know that in the Litvish world, the Gedolim had no issue with the women going to college, even getting advanced degrees. The men, they didn't want to. So they said there's a bit of a culture gap. That's the story that they brought in Rav Dov Schwartzman, who was a goon, really, an unbelievable Eloi, but he didn't have much in common with her. His son is a big kanoi. His son, Rabbi Schwartzman's son, is the one who burnt Nassim Kamenetsky's book. I spent the Shabbos with Rabbi Schwartzman, and he hung out with us, the young people, even though it must have been weird because his wife, ex-wife, was there that Shabbos, but as she was there every Shabbos. Or if Dov Schwartzman hung out, when I come back to the yeshiva the next day, or this is Monday, I told Rabbi Parnas, he was blown away, but we spoke in learning, to use the rabbinic expression, and he very much hung out with us, the waiters, and I don't know what the obvious question was, Barry, that you only asked her on the third, why she went to college. All the time I was there at the hotel, only once the women realized who she was, and she spoke for the women, but I would have loved, she gave a special class to the women who were there that Shabbos, but I would love to have asked her many questions. Okay, well, I don't want to keep you in suspense because I don't know when it's going to be, but Rav Rabbi Aaron Kotler wanted as his son-in-law, Rav Shlomo Gurin. And I will show you all the evidence very soon on a post. I'll even show you the written evidence of this. That's who he wanted. What was the name of the daughter, the Frankfurt Chazan, who was the opera singer? The name of the daughter, the name of her is Rosa, R-O-S-A, Olitska. She has a whole Wikipedia page, but it doesn't give the her Orthodox angle. It just says her father was a cantor. I don't know if at the end of her life she was still Orthodox, but when she was in the 1910s and 20s, she was 100% Orthodox, and they were proud of her in the Orthodox world in Frankfurt. David says, Rabbi Kefa tells the story of the wedding officiated by Baruch Ber Leibowitz of Kamenetz in New York for a wedding of a Talmud's child when he was visiting the U.S., and as soon as the chuppah was over, the groom kissed the bride, and Rabbi Baruch Ber exclaimed that this was the end of Torah, and explained that the Torah ends with the words, the end of the Sefer Devarim, it's L'Ein Yechol Yisrael. So when a couple publicly displays affection when it should be kept private, this is in front of all of Israel, that's the end of the Torah. That's very good. Very nice, Rabbi Baruch Ber. In connection with compromise, I once introduced Rav Schechter, and he spoke of how to write a will according to Halacha. He added, no previous Talmud Chacham could speak on this topic, but no problem in America with Shabbos observance, and this preoccupied the rabbi in not writing a will. Obviously, the rabbis, thank you for this. The rabbis were, people don't realize, they think like in the year 1910, it was like today, people were concerned about the things we're concerned about. It wasn't that at all. Getting basic things. Dancing was the last thing they'd be concerned about. So Susanna says, Scarborough Fraz, Don Alam, Simon Agarfichel, Dvorah Yikra. Yes, that's true. And someone privately texts that, I don't need to show you the picture, but I will show you next, that Rav Soloveitchik danced a mitzvah danced with her, with a napkin. David says, the talking voice is being part of the Yisra Kol Yish is asserted by Rav Yehuda. But I think this exchange is not meant to be taken literally, it needs to be read in context. Pretty much everyone assumes that it's not a question of a talking voice. Even though it says call, it's a talking voice that's sensuous. And they say that by definition, singing is sensuous, except when it's not sensuous. And that's why the different heterim they gave at the Maimonides School in Boston, since someone just mentioned the Rav. Let me read you something here. They won't want me to read you this. I wonder who they are. This is in this book, in Seth Farber's book on our Maimonides Rabbi Soloveitchik. If you turn to page 165, it mentions in the note, at the first Hanukkah concert of the Maimonides School, the program included Betty Brooks, a prominent radio personality, singing a variety of Jewish and English songs. So we know that this was viewed differently. Fiddler on the Roof. Is there any show that take their people to Fiddler on the Roof, or didn't go to Fiddler on the Roof? Today, they wouldn't do that, but the world, and even as we speak, YU, well, not this year, but YU still has its annual trip to the opera. They still have, they'll have it next year, they still have their annual, I don't know what you call it, night at the opera, whatever word it is, for to raise money. They didn't get rid of it. It still goes on. Okay, so someone privately says the question to Zachariah specifically asks about Som HaAsor. Yeah, you're right, the fast of the 10th day. Maybe Rav Simcha Zelig would say that the Chachamim in the days of Zachariah established it, the fast, and Zachariah did the... I don't know. I don't know the answer. It's a good question. Right? We don't have Rav Simcha Zelig to ask us. And someone says that she thinks she remembers a Maimonides dinner where there's female singing and the Rav walked out. Could be. The Rav is one of those who held that it's situational, that it depends. And this is, if you read Rav Moshe Lichtenstein's piece, this has been a big issue in Israel. So do you have to walk out when the girl is singing the national anthem, or they sing a song for the Holocaust? And the religious Zionist rabbi's attitude is no, that these are not the sort of songs that we're talking about, and the more Haredi elements are saying it's an absolute thing. It's an older issue. And finally, the last question, I mentioned last week that Rav Avadya listened to called Thum. You heard that he stopped doing so after seeing a photo of her. Do you think it's true? Hagiographic. It's not only not true. No one says it's true. He continued listening her whole life to her. And when I asked his son, how could he do that? When his tshuva says you can't, he says that he changed his mind. And he held that it wasn't an issue of if you see her. And this is not even denied by the students. There's even an article that appeared after Avadya's death, and he talked about how he'd listen to her in the car when they were driving places, and he'd curse her. So no, he knew what he was. And Kaltum was only the most, after Nasser, after King Farouk, and then after King Farouk, she was the most popular person. Her face was the most widely known in all of Egypt after the king. And she was the most widely, her face would have been on every street corner. So yes, obviously Rav Avadya knew what she looked like. And he never stopped listening to her music. As his son said, but he never stopped. And no one has said that. He just held that, as Rav Avadya, Avram Yosef said, that it's only an issue if it's a live performance. And it doesn't matter if you know what they look like, because he changed his mind. And I showed you last class, or the class before, that you actually find in Yabia Omer in the later volume, he tells you he changes his mind. So it's not just Rav Avram Yosef saying that. It's explicitly in the tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef. Okay, I want to thank you all for your questions and comments. This interesting stuff. Next week, we'll take you, as I said, we'll Eidah and the issue of bas mitzvahs, and then there's someone who from Israel who emailed me. Him and some others are very troubled by one of the tshuvot coming. So it's a problematic responsum, but we won't get to that, I don't think, next time. We'll get to it the next time. We have a long way to go, though, so I thank you all again, everyone. Rabbi Kelman, any announcements?
Thank you. No, just to reiterate for those who weren't here at the beginning, tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Joseph Malavani, Chazam Malavani, we'll be talking, interpreting prayers from Nusach Tefillah. Very interesting, a little bit different than some of the stuff we do, but I think he's fascinating. Explain how the Nusach really tells us how to daven. The first, like, Perusha Tefillah. Wednesday morning, Yehuda Mirsky starts his series on Shuvan Rav Kook. Saturday, we're going to have a Thursday morning, Alex Israel continues. Friday morning, I continue Perkei Avot, the last one of the season. Saturday night, Menachem Liptag on the Yud Gimel Midot, and we look forward to learning with you. And thank you, Mark, and Rabbi Gorin as Rav Aaron Kotler's son-in-law. Boy, would that been fun. But I imagine it was different then.
Okay, before I go, to just respond to someone quickly. If I mentioned classes, earlier classes, where are they? If you go to the Torah in Motion website, they're not video. So I'll describe things you see, but you won't see that. But all the previous classes are on the Torah in Motion website. And you could listen to even these if you want, not on YouTube, as podcasts in the car. You can listen to YouTube in the car, but I wouldn't advise it, because when I say something which maybe is interesting, you don't want to take your head off the road to look at it. But
everything, we have over 1,000 MP3s, but those just by sound. The YouTube only started when we moved into Zoom. So since March, but we probably have by now probably at least 175 classes up on YouTube. If anybody would like to watch there, people are watching. People are watching, and okay. Nice to see everybody. Everybody can say hello. People can unmute themselves, but okay. Lila Tov, everybody. Be well. Thank you, and have a good one, everybody.